Welcome to the Collector's Show, where you'll learn insider secrets about collecting everything. Best places to buy, how to judge authenticity, and what are the collectibles of the next generation. Here's your host, Harold Nickel.
Well, hi. Greetings and welcome. Welcome to the Collector's Show here on Web Talk Radio with me, Harold Nickel, your host, who is going to take you on yet another journey through the world of collecting. I like to think that people who are avid collectors or even casual collectors are smarter than most, more observant than most, and the man who's going to be on with us this week validates that and then some. Mark Bellomo has written dozens, if not hundreds, of articles about all kinds of collectible toys and action figures. His latest book, The Ultimate Guide to Vintage Star Wars, which covers figures from 1977 through 1985, is an astonishingly good book that not only talks about prices and things that merchants are interested in, but it's written in a narrative form. It's a fun read. Even if you don't like Star Wars, this is a really good book. And to validate how good it is, the first printing sold out. But we'll get more into that with Mark during the interview segment. Of course, as always, the most popular part of the show on any given week is news from the world of collecting. Now, the first story is about a man whose name is Jordan Geller. Jordan was a lawyer, but he turned his back on courtrooms. I started to say he turned his back on the law, but then that would make him a criminal. But he's not. He passed the California bar and decided that law wasn't for him. So now he has the profession of shoe flipper. He buys and sells Nikes. He buys them, I think, at regular retail prices, but can turn them over for 10, if not 100 times their value. There's a picture of what they call Red October, which are Air Jordans. Now, the initial price is like $150, $175, which, you know, kind of a lot for sneakers, I guess, but for Air Jordans, not that much. He sold them for $11,000. They refer to them as hidden treasure. This story was in the BBC, of all places, which makes me want to talk with a British accent, but I won't. But these Air Jordan shoes come out, and people literally lose their minds. There was a riot at a mall in Houston last week when some of these shoes were brought out. Now, according to the BBC, roughly a quarter of all sneaker sales, or resales, I guess I should say, occur on eBay. But there's a swap meet called Sneakerhead, and it's a great way to get to know people who also like to collect shoes. There are websites and meetups, SneakerCon, the Sneaker Summit, Crepe City, Sneakerness, that's in Europe. And then there are places to go and find prices for them. I'll post it on our website. Oh, I love this website, Kicksworth, and of course the Sneaker Price Guide, which seems a little pedestrian, no pun intended, compared to Sneaker Freaker Swamp Meet, which is in Australia. Who knew? Who knew that shoes could be that popular and and that expensive? All right, moving right along. This is a story from the Herald Dispatch in Huntington, West Virginia. I've actually been to Huntington. A reporter yelled at me there once upon a time, and it was on Good Friday, of all things, but that's a story for another day. Rosary beads, they're popular as aids to prayer, but they're also collectible. They're instruments for meditation. Catholics are known to use them. Other religions have them too. But regardless of who or what religion, they have a following, and they are also collectible. It turns out there's two types of rosary beads to collect. One is made with string, and the other is made with a chain. And on the chain, each bead is strung intermittently along the length. Most rosaries are the chain variety, and they tend to be valued at a much higher price. For example, the Dominican rosary has 59 beads, and it's the most popular. There are all kinds of materials made or used to make rosary beads. And if that weren't news enough, there's a book about it. The Rosary Collector's Guide is by Gloria Brady Hoffner and Helen Hoffner. And it's a book that a lot of rosary bead collectors recommend. And they also have a website, although thank you, Herald Dispatch, for not publishing what the website address is. I'll find it and post it to the Collector Show website. Now, this story is short but noteworthy because these people plant their collectible. It's a couple also in West Virginia who, along with their dog Rudolph, who's a Weimaraner, which is very hard to say, they go out and they find ugly Christmas trees. But they don't take them home and decorate them. They take them home and plant them. And they've got quite the forest of ugly trees. All right. In the time remaining for news, this may be my favorite story ever. I think this is the best story I've ever come across for the news segment of the Collector's Show. And it sums it right up for me. Weird museums. This was a paper in Washington State, and they list weird museums. Now, there was one in Seattle, but they say if you're tired of art and history, go find yourself a weird museum based on even weirder collections. Now, the one in Seattle was the Dialysis Museum. Seattle has lots of unusual and even obscure attractions. There's a thing called the Gum Wall at the Pike Place Market, but another one is, like I say, the Dialysis Museum. The Northwest Kidney Centers opened the free museum 2 years ago to celebrate its 50th anniversary as a pioneering medical treatment center. People who find old medical devices intriguing and those whose lives have been touched by kidney disease are most likely to seek it out. The museum shows the history of dialysis through machines and photos and some early hospital models from the 40s, a home travel machine, some machines that were one-of-a-kind devices created with spare parts from others, one of which included a traveling kidney in a suitcase. Their website is nwkidney.org. Oh, I have to get them on the show. Here's another odd museum, and I've actually been, not to this museum, but in East Lansing, Michigan, the Moistelet Museum. I'm not kidding. It says this free attraction is next to the Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State University, and it's one of the odder collections that's open to the public. On two big bookcases in John French's office are more than, get this, 1,000, and I love this, mostly unused wet wipes from around the world. The celebrity wing of the collection includes a used wipe, donated by Car Talk hosts Ray and the late Tom Magliosi. Oh, that's gross. A used towelette. John French is also the planetarium's production coordinator, said the collection includes wipes from a sumo wrestling event in Japan and another from the former Trump's castle in Atlantic City. And of course, the question is, why moist towelettes? Well, Mr. French says, I think everybody has an urge to collect something. The collection's oldest item is a box of wash-up towelettes from 1963. I guess it's like, you know, matchbook covers, moist towelettes, barf bags. The National Museum of Funeral History is in Houston, Texas. It says it's a serious cultural and historic museum, but it also has a sense of fun, illustrated by its trademark, "Any day above ground is a good one." Now, the tastefulness of this museum is called into question, if not by that expression, but the fact that it also has an annual haunted house. Its exhibits include artifacts from presidential and celebrity funerals, historical hearses, and a full-scale replica of an embalming station from a Civil War battlefield. It costs $10 to get in. That may be the best $10 I ever spend. And finally, the Ventriloquist Museum in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Remember, you can't spell Kentucky without KY. The Vent Haven Museum houses 800 ventriloquist dummies, thousands of photographs of famous performers, and a library full of ventriloquism books. Figures on display include a replica of the Charlie McCarthy, who was Edgar Bergen's sidekick. And no, I'm not old enough to remember Edgar Bergen, but I've seen it on YouTube. The museum has one puppet on which visitors can try out their skills. It's only open May through September, and it costs $10 to get in. Now, that's just a few. I don't have time to read all of them. The Toilet Seat Art Museum, the Titan Missile Museum, the Wrench Museum, the Mutter Medical Oddities Museum, the Glore Psychiatric Museum, and, of course, the Museum of Sex. This is the best story ever. And you know I'm going to try to get these people on. All right. Enough of my foolishness and on to Star Wars collectibles with our guest Mark Belomo here on The Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel. You know, if you're listening to this program, you're a collector. You're looking to buy something for your existing collection. You're looking to sell part of your collection, or you're looking for that one thing that would complete your collection. And some of the best places to do any of those things are at flea markets or bargain stores. So you can sit in front of your computer until your eyes cross and not find a flea market that is nearby. Well, you could do that until now, because there's a new app called the Flea Market Finder. It's so ingenious. You just enter your location and hit search, and it will come back and give you a list of flea markets and bargain stores within whatever mile radius you tell it. Now, I told it within 50 miles of where I live here in Southeast Texas. It's close to Houston. I got pages of flea markets and bargain stores where I could go. So gone are the days when you're flipping through the classifieds to see where the flea market is, what their hours are, or address. Because in addition to telling you the names of these flea markets, it plots them out on a map for you. It'll give you directions. It even gives you the phone number. No more wasting time looking for a place to sell your collection or add to it. The Flea Market Finder is free. Now, they have a pro version that costs a whopping 99 cents. That's the one I got. But the other one is free. Try it out. Go to iTunes, download it. It'll work on your iPad or your iPhone. Find the item you need by finding a flea market resource near you. The Flea Market Finder app. Get it now at iTunes. Go now. It's the interview segment of The Collector's Show, and this week we are joined by Mark Belomo. Mark, to say that he is an accomplished author and collector just doesn't sum it up. He has written hundreds of articles about toys and action figures going back to the 1980s, and I think written a library full of books about vintage action figures and pop culture. Most recently, He wrote The Ultimate Guide to Vintage Star Wars for 1977 through 1985. It's a book that covers every action figure, accessory, creature, mail-away, playset, vehicle, and weapon system from Kenner's original Star Wars toy line, along with a wealth of text that discusses the history of the characters. It's an incredible work. I understand the first printing sold out already, and we'll get to all that. But before we get too far, Mark, welcome to the Collector's Show.
Thank you, Harold, very much for having me. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for making time.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, you're a busy guy, and I appreciate you carving out some time for us. And I, like I said in the intro, I want to talk about your latest Star Wars action figure book. But before we dive into that too deeply, tell me how you first got interested in collecting, and what was it that you first collected?
I was the smallest kid in my class in elementary school and probably the most introverted. So because of those two forces, I retreated into escapist fantasy and science fiction, comic books and toys and action figures at a very early age. My mom's not from this country, so I was raised with a European upbringing. My mom and dad worked 7 days a week, so I wasn't a latchkey kid, but I spent a lot of time imaginatively by myself. And the first toy line that I really got into was Mego in the 70s was very popular.
Right.
And they're comic action heroes. They're little 3 3/4-inch superhero figures that they made in 1976 when I was 5 years old. My Aunt Marie bought me one of those, and I never went back. I leapt into their 8-inch tall official World's Greatest Superhero figures, and then I started collecting Amazing Spider-Man comics and the Marvel Tales reprints of the old Ditko Spider-Man. And then my Aunt Marie in 1977 bought me a C-3PO figure at retail, and I never looked back. That's
so cool, and you know, I think a lot of people who maybe weren't the biggest, most athletic, funniest, or best looking ended up doing those kinds of things, getting into collecting and finding ways to, you know, put their time and their intellect to work in school. So I say good for you, and myself and probably most of the people listening were right there with you. Now, Disney bought the Star Wars franchise from Lucas, and they've got a new movie coming out next December. Here's what I don't get, and since you've written about pop culture, I think you can help answer this question. I thought the Star Wars movies, the first three, were very entertaining. I thought the next three, not so much. How has the Star Wars phenomena survived all this time?
You know, I was doing some research last night, and my wife and I began to put on episode one, and I think she stopped and said, why is this so different than the first three movies? Why am I not connecting with it? And my response to her was, because it's not made for you. Collectors, I think Lucas and Lucasfilm realized that collectors were going to buy the films and go see the new trilogy, episodes 1 through 3, regardless. So what their job, from a marketing standpoint, was to inculcate a new tribe of consumers. If you go back and you talk to the kids in 1999, the American children who were children watching episode 1, and ask them if they enjoyed that movie, the kids will say, oh, I loved that movie.
Huh.
Diehard collectors, maybe not. So from a marketing standpoint, Lucasfilm did their job. And I think that's what they're trying to do now with, if you look at the new animated series, Star Wars Rebels, if you look at iTunes downloads, that show is always in the top 10 of iTunes downloads. And it's very much, the main characters is quite similar to the Disney character, the lead from Aladdin, Aladdin himself. So it's getting another tribe of consumers brought to that license. I'm always going to be there. You're always going to be there.
That's
We're going to buy a ticket. they're concerned about getting all those new consumers into that brand, and I think they've done that quite successfully.
I'll say, and you know, it's funny that you say that, because now that you mention it, that character does look like Aladdin, and probably not a coincidence. There's a funny line. I'm a huge Simpsons fan, and they're making fun of the first movie, and the character comic book guy on The Simpsons says, you know, worst movie ever. I will only see it three more times. So I think you've nailed
it. Well, you
it.
Say that, you know, you say that, Harold, and it's very complicated because I'm kind of a member of the media, and I try not to editorialize in my books. I have stock answers ready for when reporters or interviewers ask me about those films in particular. Did you like episode one? Did you like episode two? Did you like episode three? And my stock answer is, if the movie is critically well-received, people are going to want to go back to A Better Vanished Time and buy my book.
That's right.
But if the movie is critically panned, people are going to want to go back to A Better Vanished Time and buy my book. So I'm in a win-win situation. Very, very lucky to be in a win-win situation.
Well, when you put it that way, I guess so. But the first three movies were critically acclaimed and well-received. And I'm a little older than you. I was in high school when the first one came out. And that's really what your book details, the action figures from 77 through 85. Why did you choose to write about that period?
You know, there are a couple reasons. The first, of course, is they're the most iconic characters. And I don't self-publish my books. I work for book companies. So my ultimate goal is to make them money to sell books,
mm-hmm.
you know, from a very clinical perspective. So if my job is to sell books, who is more iconic, Ben Obi-Wan Kenobi or Sayo Bibble from the second trilogy?
Right.
You know, I had to go with the most iconic characters, Luke, Leia, Han, R2-D2, C-3PO. They're touchstones. They take us back to that Better Vanished Time, to that almost Holden Caulfield reaching for that golden ring type thing, going back to that moment of innocence. You know, I was 6 years old when Star Wars came out in May of 1977, and I remember sitting on top of my mom and dad's navy blue Volkswagen Beetle and watching that movie at a drive-in, and it brings me back to that time. The other reason why I chose 1977 and 1985 to focus on the book is because it limits my scope
mm-hmm.
from a practical standpoint. And that's why I write books about vintage toys, because I could go on and on forever. I mean, you could write, if I wanted to cover every Star Wars figure, vehicle, weapon, accessory, creature, playset, and mail away, you're talking 10 volumes. Because I limit my scope and say we're only going to do 1977 and 1985, I can basically get a page count in my head and say we're going to need this many pages to deliver this book.
Yeah, that's really interesting that it gives you boundaries to work within. And like you say, I don't think there's anybody anywhere that wouldn't know who Luke Skywalker was, but some of the characters from the later movies wouldn't be nearly as recognizable. Those characters, like you mentioned, are iconic and easily recognizable. And you make another good point. You know, publishers are in business to make money. I think so oftentimes, and I'm guilty of this, I think about collecting and writing as an art form or as a vehicle of personal expression. But at the end of the day, if somebody's not making money at it, no one will care. So that's...
Well, and let me interject there, Harold, and say, and I've been a little bit clinical in answering these questions so far, and just say to your listeners, I own 120,000 comics and 60,000 action figures, and I don't own these artifacts just to write books. Anytime I buy a comic book, I read it because I love comic books.
Yeah.
Anytime I buy an action figure, I open it and still to this day play with it. So I'm writing these books because I have a passion. I mean, to be quite honest, when I look back at the awful time I had in my formative years, action figures and comic books saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me something to go to, quite literally saved my life. So I have a deep, profound connection to these toys.
Well, and I'm glad you said that because while we all got to make money, if we can make money writing about or doing things that we really like and have a passion about, then that's so much the better for everybody. So
absolutely. I was in grad school, just another digression. I was in grad school and I was filling out my plan of study and my graduate director said, "What do you want to do?" We're talking about getting a PhD and going on to do this. And I said, "I want to write about comics and toys." And he said, "Can you make money doing that?"
Right.
And I said, "I don't know. I'm going to try it." So I'm very fortunate to be doing what I'm doing.
And that's something that if there's a thread that runs through the people who come on the Collector Show, it's that 9 out of 10 of them make a living at their collection. So, yeah, you can follow a passion and make a living. Now, I had said I was older than you, and I'm a good bit older. I just turned 56, and when I was growing up in the 60s, the very first action figure was G.I. Joe. But then later came Major Matt Mason from Mattel. And from where I sit today, that toy was a watershed in terms of weapons, vehicles, action settings, the size of Major Matt Mason. And I'm wondering if Kenner, who came out with the first line in 77, or other similar manufacturers may have taken a page out of Mattel's book. What do you think about that?
Well, let me think here. My wheelhouse is the 80s, because that's really when I grew up and was quite immersed in action figures. But in the last 5 to 10 years, because of the tanking of the market due to the Great Recession in 2008, I've gone back and I've kind of bought $6 Million Man stuff. I've gotten into Micronauts. I've gotten into Mark's playsets. And I've gotten some Major Matt Mason stuff, and I started getting into the 12-inch G.I. Joes as well, and really appreciating the toys that came out before I was a kid. So if your question is, you know, did Kenner learn from Mattel, or was there some other example, I think the philosophy that many marketing executives discovered in the 60s and the 70s was what's called the razor and the blade philosophy.
Tell us about that.
Well, what that means is, and I think Mattel in 1959 with Barbie struck upon a pretty brilliant marketing scheme, which is when you look at that first Barbie in that zebra-striped bathing suit, that's all she came with. She came with shoes and the zebra-striped bathing suit. That's your razor. We're going to sell millions of these units to girls around the country. But that's all she came with. So now let's sell the blades.
Now I get it.
Barbie's going to need outfits. So that's what they did with G.I. Joe. That was replicated by Stan Weston and Don Levine, the people who are responsible for G.I. Joe and Hasbro. Don just passed away in May. God rest his soul. God rest their souls. But they hit on that for boys and said, we're going to sell the standard action soldier, action sailor, action pilot, and action marine. They're going to come with fatigues and a cap and boots and a training manual, but they're not going to come with any accessories. You have to buy accessory sets, which are the blades. So this razor and the blade philosophy really sailed in the face of what Marx was doing with their play sets in the 50s, which was, for 1999, the kid gets everything in one box for Christmas. Now, realizing the buying power of kids in the late 60s and in the 70s, they started to almost tailor it to that you've got to buy more, collect them all mentality.
Yeah, that's it. Finally, I think people listening may have seen through their headphones the light go off over my head when I understood the analogy of razor and blade. So Yeah, it's another example is the inexpensive printer that we all have on our desk, but it's the ink that's where they get you. So it really
and
was
get you well. I mean, ink cartridges over the course of a year probably cost more than what your printer was.
Easily, and I'm old fashioned. I like paper, but
right.
But that's such a good analogy. So that red thread that starts with Barbie runs all the way down through the figures in the Kenner line. Now, one of the things in the book, and I had a chance to just preview it, something I had never heard of in the collecting of Star Wars were things that you mail away for. Tell me about those, because that was really brand new for me.
Well, I mean, Kenner was a division of General Mills, and General Mills produced foods. You know, mm-hmm. Kenner Products was a division of General Mills, and Kenner was an American toy company from, I think, 47 to 95. And Kenner had kind of really established themselves in the 60s with items like the Give a Show projector in 1959 and the Easy Bake Oven in 63 and Spirograph in 66. But when they hit on Star Wars, I think they really started to utilize their knowledge of what they learned marketing foods like cereal. So Kenner started to utilize the proof of purchase seals as part of redemptions. So that first Boba Fett, you'd clip out proof of purchase seals, you'd mail them into Kenner, and you'd get the free Boba Fett figure. And they did this over and over and over throughout the duration of that vintage line. You know, from Boba Fett to Bossk to all these other characters like Anakin Skywalker. And I think it took them by surprise how many kids were interested. Plus, it sold through figures a lot more. We've got to remember that from 77 to 85, Kenner sold somewhere north of 300 million Star Wars figures.
Wow.
And these redemptions put into the line in a timely manner helped them to sell through.
See, that's so interesting that they monetized something that they had learned in the cereal business. And even before proof of purchase, you used to do box tops and send those in for things. That's amazing. And 300 million, that's like the population of North America.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around that. And it's those original figures, I think, that really kick things off. And in my reading, there were 12 of those, and they called it, I think, the 12 back set, because all 12 were printed on the back of the carton or the package that they all came in. And I've seen that a set of all 12 goes for north of $26,000.
Okay.
With 300 million of them manufactured, how do they command a price like that?
Okay, so let's take a step back. When Kenner first started producing Star Wars action figures in 1978, for sale at retail, they packaged them on what collectors like to call card backs, which is a chipboard back with a colorful picture on it, and then they'd put the figure in a translucent bubble with its accessories and stick it on that card back.
Mm-hmm.
When Star Wars figures were originally solicited, they only made 12 in the beginning, and on the back of the package, on the back of that card back, they printed an image of each member of those original 12 figures. So on the original packaging, the original 12 figures, on their original packaging, because as they added more figures, 21 back, 30, the figures got bigger. But if you buy them on that original packaging, those are called 12 back cards.
Okay.
R2-D2, Chewbacca, Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, Ben, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Darth Vader, Han Solo, C-3PO, Stormtrooper, Death Squad Commander, Jawa, and the Sand Person. Those are the first 12 characters. So of course they would be worth more on that packaging. Now, let's say a Luke Skywalker figure, the farm boy Luke with that yellow lightsaber, he was made, that action figure was made from 1977, 1978, until 1985. So there were millions of those Luke Skywalker figures produced. So loose, outside of the packaging, and complete, he might be, let's say, $18 to $25. But sealed on that original 12-back card in really good condition, and condition is everything, you could be talking $650 to $1,000, depending on the condition.
Man, that's serious. That's serious dough. So,
is serious dough. Yes.
So, since people like to make money and enjoy their collectibles, I'm going to ask you to do something that you may or may not be qualified for, and that's help us predict the future with the new movie coming out. If I were going to start my 21st century Star Wars action figure collection, what would be a good place to start?
Are you asking about to turn a profit?
Yeah, turn a profit or have a meaningful collection, or preferably both.
Okay, let's start with to turn a profit. Once a year, I write basically the industry standard for collectible toys post-World War II, and it's called Toys and Prices. So I basically have had to memorize the price of almost every toy post-World War II in existence.
Wow.
I work this a couple hours a day every day. However, if you're looking to make money from Star Wars, I have some bad news.
Oh, no.
Because the trailer has already dropped, and because people are already getting excited to make money off Star Wars now, vintage Star Wars, you're probably going to have to invest a considerable sum. Hmm. Simply because if you buy one of the cheaper items, they're cheaper for a reason, because there's little demand. In order to turn a profit off Star Wars, you'd have to invest in some of those 12-backs. If you can find them for a decent price, then ultimately what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to flip them basically the weekend the new movie premieres. And I'll give you an example. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the Marvel movie Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah. Thought it was terrific.
It was a great movie. The second there were rumblings in Hollywood that that movie was going to get made, what I did was I looked into the Guardians of the Galaxy series from 2008. I bought a bunch of copies of the first issue for like $5. I also found the first appearance of Rocket Raccoon, the first appearance of Drax, the first appearance of some of those major characters, Star-Lord, and I bought them at a very cheap price. The weekend that the movie succeeded,
mm-hmm.
I sold those for many multiple times what they were originally worth. But I had to jump on that immediately. Right now, Star Wars prices have already begun to increase. And what I mean by that is I sent in the manuscript for this Star Wars book in March of this year. The last thing I do when I submit a manuscript for a collectibles book is I put down the prices.
Right.
The prices in my book are already starting to become out of date because of the interest in the line. So we may have missed the boat on investing in Star Wars unless it's high price items, but whenever you see a new Marvel movie, like, I don't know, Doctor Strange,
mm-hmm.
they just announced they're making a film, you should probably look into the first appearance of Doctor Strange, and if you can buy that for very, very inexpensive amount of money, then invest in that. There are always opportunities in the collectibles market, but you have to be poised and ready to leap on it the second that news is heard.
You are the man. I think you just helped fund my retirement. I'm going to go to Google News and put in an alert for Marvel and movie as soon as we're finished recording the interview. So I guess that's, like you say, you have to be, like you have to have a lifetime's worth of knowledge really to be able to make money at it. So let's talk about starting a collection that might be meaningful, if not profitable. What would be a good place to start?
Well, you know, congratulations. If you want to buy Star Wars stuff from the 70s and the 80s, you can probably buy every figure, vehicle, creature, and playset from, let's say, the Star Wars line, 1977, 1978. You can probably buy everything, mint loose, complete, not including, like, the store exclusives. You could probably buy it for under $1,000.
Wow.
That's... I mean, I've done the math on this. That's all the 12 originals and then the newer Star Wars characters that came, Hammerhead and Greedo and Boba Fett, the Land Speeder, the TIE Fighter, the X-Wing Fighter, the Death Star Space Station, the Land of the Jawas. Because they made so many of them, you could probably buy all that stuff for under $1,000 in decent condition. But start with a figure. Start with a figure that speaks to you the most. I mean, growing up, you were either my age growing up when you were an adolescent. You were either a Luke Skywalker guy or a Han Solo guy.
Right.
So, but or if, you know, my sister, she was Princess Leia. So buy the figure that you like the most, and then, you know, when the opportunity presents itself, when you find something for a decent price, pick it up.
Yeah, that's good advice. I think, you know, buy the things that resonate with you, and the rest takes care of itself.
Yes.
With the time we have left, let's talk about your book. I understand it's doing really well, so much so that there's a second edition or a second printing coming out. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't use the word blessed very often. I just don't. But I'm very fortunate. I'm very lucky that people have been responding to it. I tried to make it less clinical and more. As we spoke before the interview began, you commented that it seems to have almost a narrative bent to it,
yeah.
And that's what I tried to do. I didn't just talk about these, like, clinical static artifacts. I wanted them to be dynamic, so when you pick up the book and you read about Han Solo, I talk about him growing up as an orphan, very similar to Oliver Twist. I talk about him working for the Empire, flying TIE fighters until he meets Chewbacca, who was a prisoner of the Empire, and then he gets drummed out of the Corps, and I talk about the history of every character. So it's eminently readable, and one thing I also like to do is I want to make my books appealing to everyone, so there's no vulgarity, there's no, you know, lasciviousness to it. I want this to be something that you can hand to your kid or your kid's kids that you can read successively in successive generations. I wanted to make it approachable, but still informative. You know, the goal of this is to make it, there's utility. If you have a box of Star Wars figures, loose Star Wars figures and their parts, or their vehicles and their parts, and you dump it on your kitchen table, and you have my book, you should be able, utilizing the book, to pair up everything and then put it on eBay.
Yeah, we did talk, you know, a little bit about it. It does have that really, you know, fun to read narrative quality to it. It's entertaining, it's informative, and so often I'll see these collecting guides and it's just page after page of prices and dollar signs, and that's useful, but at least for me, not terribly entertaining. And I thought what I saw of what you had done was all of the above, so congratulations to you. And the fact that it has sold out and has to be printed again, I think, is testimony to what a fine piece of literature it is. What's next for you? Are you going to write another book or start another collection?
Well, I have so many toys. Right now what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to finish my respective superhero lines. You know, as far back as superhero action figures existed back in you know, 1966 with the Captain Action stuff. And I'm almost done with that. So I work at a college during the day, and I work on my books at night. So I also work for IDW Comics, where I kind of preside over some of their trade paperback collections. I work on G.I. Joe, the complete collection. I helped to put together their Transformers classic stuff. But I think the next thing I'd like to get into, looking at what Warner Brothers, DC movies, and Disney's Marvel movies, what the plans are for the next 5 to 10 years, I think I'd like to work on some superhero books. I think that's the goal right now, is to get these superhero books out to the public in the same manner as the vintage Star Wars book, make them readable, make them accessible, and take people to back to that better vanished time when they were kids. Take them back like a time machine.
Oh, that's so well said. And, you know, it's nostalgia and recreating one's childhood is a topic that we talk about here all the time. And before we go, how can we get a copy of your book?
This is what I tell people. Buy my book wherever it's cheapest. Go to Amazon, go to Books a Million, go to Barnes and Nobles. You know, I think Amazon's selling it for $17 or $18 shipped. So wherever it's cheapest, you know, to get it in your hands. If you ever have any questions, if you ever have any comments, type my name into Facebook. I usually respond within the hour. You know, I'm not writing these books in a vacuum. I'm writing them because I'm a fan myself, and I try and reach out to fans of the lines and of my books as much as possible.
Well, I know that listeners and readers, collectors, enthusiasts will be pleased that you're so responsive to people who, like you and like me, really have a passion for these kinds of things. And Mark Bellamo, I hope I said your name right, did I?
People have been pronouncing it Bellamo. If you buy my book, you're entitled to pronounce it however you want.
Okay.
But I think it's Italian for Bellomo, so Bellomo is fine, however you want to pronounce it.
Well, I'm just going to say, Mark, thanks for making time for us this week on The Collector's Show.
Thank you very much, Harold, and anytime you want to have me, just give me a call, and I'll show up.
Absolutely. You'll hear from me. One more quick word before we go right after this here on The Collector's Show. Well, before I get to our takeaway from our conversation with Mark Bellamo today, I want to talk a little bit about the Life 360 app. Now, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks, and as the holidays are here, if you're listening to this podcast in real time, you're going to be out shopping with your family and your friends. You're going to be going out to eat. You're going to be traveling. You're going to be doing a lot of driving, flying. Now, you might be in a boat or a bus. Your family and your friends are going to want to know where you are. What better time than now to get the Life 360 app for your iPhone or for your Android phone? You can know with certainty where somebody is because you can track them in real time using the Life 360 app. So if you wonder where your grandparents are, your cousins, mom and dad, if they've got the Life 360 app and they're part of your network, you will know. Now, I'm lucky that for this year at least, we don't have to do any traveling. We moved to be close to family and friends, but we've also been in situations and lived, you know, frankly, most of our adult lives in different parts of the country and had to do the whole fly, drive, hitchhike, boat thing. Well, I know that my family would have been a lot happier if they knew exactly where we were. And if they had had the Life 360 app, they could have. The price on this gift for you is definitely right. It's free. Go to iTunes and download it. It's also on Google. It's available in all of the formats needed for all of the modern pads and phones. So go get it. If you get it from iTunes, you can go ahead and subscribe to The Collector Show at the same time. Give yourself and your family and your friends the best gift they will ever receive, the gift of peace of mind, the Life 360 app. Go get it right now. And like I was saying, talking to Mark Bellomo was really an education, and unlike you, I got to talk to him before and after we taped the interview, and I got to tell you, that's a guy who really not just knows a lot about Star Wars, but really knows a lot about how action figures and that movie in particular relates to our culture. And I love the points that he made about, from a marketing point of view, how Lucas and Disney were inaugurating or initiating a new generation or generations into the Star Wars culture club, so to speak. But he also made an interesting point, and I really agree with this, and it's worth saying again. Find the figure you like and find the figure that you can relate to and collect that. If you make money at it, hey, that's great. But most of us will never make any money on our collections. Count me as part of that group. But you know what? I collect things that give me pleasure. And I loved his turn of a phrase about how they remind you of a better vantage time in your life. That really sums it all up for those of us who are collectors. Okay, next week, not in time for Christmas, but better late than never, we're going to be talking to somebody about collecting Hallmark Christmas ornaments. Now, Marla and I own literally a barn full of them, and we love them, and we have so many of them we can't even get them all out. So this is going to be a great interview for us. Hallmark collectible Christmas ornaments during the week between Christmas and New Year's, next week on The Collector Show. Thanks for being here.